Joining me now on the phone, I have Summit County Council Member Kim Carson. Good morning, Kim.
Good morning, Leslie.
So I know you're on your way down to the state legislature. Anything in particular you're watching there?
A few things. Pardon me, a little raspy this morning. Medicaid expansion, of course, is one that we're very concerned about and looking at closely. It did pass through the Senate on Monday, and the proposal is to expand Medicaid up to 100% of the poverty level. Under the ACA, it's required that you go to 138%. So the state of Utah is, if this bill passes through the House and the governor signs it, they will be requesting a waiver to be able to go to the 100% level. That means about 50,000 fewer people in the state would be served. So that's something we're going to continue to look at. And
how does that affect Summit County's health services at all?
Well, in order to pay, the legislature doesn't feel like the additional tax that was in the proposition will cover the cost, especially future costs. So what they're proposing is immediate cuts to different mental health-related programming in order to help make that up. So they're looking at like $15 million worth of cuts. And those will affect Summit County. We're looking at our drug court program, justice reinvestment program, and then a number of other substance use disorder funding. So we're really concerned about that.
Yeah,
and if they implement those cuts and then they don't get the waiver, then there will be no Medicaid expansion. And our concern then, too, is if they've already made those cuts to the mental health program, it'll be really difficult to get those dollars back.
And this is even being done even with the whopper of the surplus that we've got, huh?
Yes. Now, the surplus primarily comes from income tax, and those income tax dollars are targeted directly toward education. So that's a good thing. They should funnel as much of that as they can into education, but it looks like they're looking at a tax cut instead.
Okay. There was a report in yesterday's Salt Lake Tribune that some folks in San Juan County looking to allow communities to split off and form a new county. Any idea if this would affect Summit County?
It could affect any county. Basically, right now, if somebody is going to split off, everybody in the county has the opportunity to vote on that proposal. So this is saying that only those in the area that would be splitting off have the opportunity to vote. And that's really concerning, because I don't know if you remember when the Canyon School District split off down in Salt Lake, and there was a big controversy over, you know, what tax dollars were going to be going into that new district. And I see this as having similar potential. So you could have a wealthy area of a county, you know, vote to split themselves off and not support the rest of the county. And I think in San Juan, what they'd like to do is split off the majority of the, or a portion of the county away from the area that includes the tribal lands.
So, I mean, this could mean that, like, the Snyderville Basin area would split off, but they wouldn't become a municipality. They'd have to become another county, huh?
Right. This is relating to county subdivision.
Okay. From the agenda, the purchase agreement for the Commons Project, Kim, you voted for that agreement and did not agree with Chris Robinson's suggestion to try resolving a deal with the amphitheater. How come?
You know, I didn't think it fit with this, and we didn't have the information we needed to be able to add that. I felt like that was a separate issue that we needed to address through another process. I understood Chris's point when we have some type of leverage to use it, but in this case, I just didn't feel like that was appropriate. And as we had more discussion with the developer, it sounds like, you know, it probably wasn't a good connection.
Also, as a member of the Summit County Health Board, the council had a discussion on the medical marijuana replacement bill. Several difficult questions here. First of all, the law says that each health district in the state has to provide at least one marijuana dispensary, but the county doesn't have to provide that if somebody sets up a private dispensary. So Does the county put in the time and money to plan a public one if you don't know that a private one may come along later?
You know, the language isn't specific enough yet for us to know. We know that we have the option to opt out, but if we opt out before knowing if there's going to be a private dispensary in the county, then we could be risking not having the medical marijuana available to our constituents that want it and need it. So we're waiting for more information. It's pretty frustrating. Another huge concern for us is right now there's nothing in the bill that provides any type of funding to the counties to set these dispensaries up. There's no guarantee that, you know, we have 75% of our funding in the health department comes from federal grants and through Medicaid and a number of different programs. So we are concerned that those funds could be at risk since cannabis is still, I forget the class, but
Schedule 1, I believe.
Schedule 1, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what do we know what the cost is? In the staff report, it looked like Health Director Rich Bulla's projections ranged anywhere from $62,000 to $156,000.
Well, for the initial setup, it would be in that $100,000 to $150,000 range, and it would depend on where we decided to set it up. There's training that's involved, security, and then ongoing costs could be anywhere between like $65,000 to $100,000 a year. So it's considerable.
In terms of where a dispensary would go, I mean, are we talking about the Quinn's Health Building?
You know, we want more information for us to be able to make a decision on that. We could do, it's important for some of us that it be on a transit line so people have access. But it also, there's a lot of things to look at, like if you have other staff available, you know, you have to have at least one person trained, but, you know, if that person's out sick, you still have to provide the service, so you need at least one backup, and that might be more readily available if we had it at the Quinn's Junction facility.
Yeah,
I think what, you know, they won't be doing any measuring or actual filling of prescriptions at the health department site, wherever it is located. There's a central fill pharmacy that the state will run, and so all of the product will come into them. They will fill prescriptions from there. They handle all of the money, and then there's a designated delivery point where the patient will pick that up, and it will then be shipped, and it has to be picked up within 24 to 48 hours, or it's sent back to the central fill pharmacy. So there won't be a lot of product, you know, at any one time in the health department building.
Yeah. So we still don't have a bus that goes to the health department in the hospital?
You know, there is a dial-a-ride that provides people service, and that's something we continue to look at. And I believe there's a stop there off of the Camas route.
Okay, but not just within Park City and the basin and the hospital.
No, it's right now service is provided through a dial-a-ride.
Okay. And is that for everybody, or is that just for, the disabled and elderly?
No, that's for anybody.
Okay. Let's see, a couple of other items before I let you go here. The East Code Amendments for Adaptive Reuses basically raises the question, how do you decide what is historically significant and who makes that decision?
The Planning Commission will make that decision, and we have asked them to streamline, like to look at those definitions. There was like four items in the packet that were criteria. So one of them is if it's a person that's had a significant place in history, if the building itself has had a significant, and there's a connection with that person to that building, if the building itself has had a significant impact on local history, So we've asked that they do a little research on those definitions and make sure that they're in line with industry standards. And but it will be up to the Planning Commission.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention, Kim?
No, you brought up medical marijuana. We are, you know, feet first into the legislative session, and we'll continue to provide updates every week and, you know, may ask people to contact our local legislators when there's issues we're really concerned about. So we appreciate it when people pay attention and can help support us in that.
Oh, okay. Summit County Councilmember Kim Carson, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Leslie.
News time now, 8:25. Good morning. Well, the second week of the 2019 Utah legislative session nearing its end. Morgan Lyon-Cotty is the Associate Director of the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah. She joins us by phone now for an analysis of the first couple of weeks. Good morning to you, Morgan.
Good morning.
So there are more than 1,000 bills at this year's session. For the past 2 weeks, one that has really dominated the news, of course, is Senator Alan Christensen. He represents a portion of Summit County. He filed Senate Bill 96, the Medicaid Adjustments Bill. It's now already moved through the Senate, a House committee, and now is waiting to be heard by the full House. Are you surprised by how quickly this piece of legislation working its way through?
I am actually surprised, especially because what senators like to say about themselves is that the Senate is slow and it's deliberate, and it doesn't usually get into very tense debates or fights, but we did see a very intense debate over this issue, and it has gone through the Senate pretty quickly. That said, Medicaid expansion has been up for debate for years at the legislature, so these are arguments that they've had many times before.
The votes have been mostly along party lines, Republicans voting for, Democrats against, except for a handful of Republicans who did cast no votes, including the floor sponsor, Representative Jim Dunnigan. I mean, why would he put his name on it if he's voting against it?
You know, it may be a sign of how things will go when it reaches the full House that a lot of Republican legislators are still pretty divided on this. A lot of your listeners may have seen some of the reporting that showed that Prop 3 passed in most legislative districts. And the lone Republican in the Senate that voted against this bill was Todd Weiler, who represents a chunk of southern Davis County, and that area, known to be pretty conservative, supported Prop 3. So there is this tug of war with some of these legislators wanting to be, you know, wanting to toe that fiscal conservative line, but also knowing that their voters supported this issue.
So at least they're recognizing, right, that they're what their constituents are asking them to do. But for those Republicans that just go ahead and approve this, I mean, will voters even notice what their lawmakers are doing? I mean, in 2 years when they run for re-election, will they remember that their representatives didn't represent them? I mean, a lot of people will just vote because the R is behind their name in Utah.
Yeah, it is a really good question. And party identity is strong and growing stronger. And the fact that we are nearly 2 years away from the next time any of these legislators will face another election, perhaps they have that in their mind, knowing that they, you know, if they do make the wrong choice, if voters are upset, they have time to make up for that or time to message that and discuss that with voters.
Yeah. If they do vote no, that the lawmakers, I mean, what kind of pressure does the leadership team put on them, if any?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that? You broke up a little.
Oh, if lawmakers do vote no on this.
Oh, do vote no.
Yeah, I mean, what kind of pressure then does the Republican leadership team put on them, if any?
Yeah, well, we see that the Republican leadership in the Senate is very in support of this. We've heard less strong comments from the Republican leadership in the House, and interestingly, from the top Republican in the state, from Governor Herbert, we've seen that he's made comments that he thinks the Proposition 3 should be going through and be implemented.
So you expect Governor Herbert then to sign it or veto it?
We don't know. We'll see what kind of public pressure he gets if this goes through with overwhelming support. And, you know, we're not hearing too much noise from the public. The governor may sign the bill. However, we have seen in the past, like with the sex education bill several years ago, when there was a public outcry, he does use that veto, though very rarely.
Yeah. And basically what Senate Bill 96 does, I mean, it would cover fewer people and actually be more expensive up front to pay for this. What about, though, Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act in general? I mean, I guess the issue is are we so sure that the ACA will be around before this bill leverages out over the long term?
Yeah, that's one of the difficult things about Medicaid and the ACA in general. There's so much uncertainty, and that we've seen that within this debate over SB 96. We're seeing a lot of the Republican legislators that support it saying they'll get that federal waiver, we'll get the federal support, but it's a big if. This is an application process that has taken months, if not years, for some states to get. So there's the questioning of that. There's the questioning of whether or not the ACA will remain the law of the land, and, you know, compounded by the fact that health care, Medicaid, Medicare, all of these are just tremendously complicated issues.
Yeah. And my understanding is that this bill would need not one but two waivers from the federal government. Is that likely to happen?
The Republican leadership that is in support of this in the Senate seems absolutely sure. I think one of them used the phrase, I'd bet the farm on it. But we know that with the federal government, it's a very large bureaucracy, and with the Trump administration, most things are far from certain.
Mm. Republicans in general, though, don't they tend to support state rights and to at least consider the state trying to do things a little bit differently?
Yeah, and we do see also one more example of that tug of war. We're seeing that that idea of federalism, the idea of states' rights and not wanting to rely on the federal government too much, but also that really important Republican tenet of fiscal conservatism, and that's what we're hearing a lot of these legislators talk about, that the math has to add up. Utah's legislators and Utah's leaders are very proud of the state budget, the fiscal well-being of the state, and that is one thing that they keep on talking about with Medicaid, making sure it's done in a fiscally sustainable way.
Let's move on to some legislation that we're seeing a lot of this session. Bills pertaining to ballot initiatives and referenda. Five bills, my understanding, making amendments of some sort. Some of these bills, such as Representative Brad Dawes' House Bill 119, change the process a bit for getting local initiatives and referenda on the ballot. How difficult is it for citizen-led legislative efforts to be pushed on the ballot?
You know, Utah has a pretty high bar for these ballot initiatives, especially if you compare us to other states. You have to get a certain percentage of the voting or the vote count from a previous election, and for the statewide ballots, it has to be in a certain number of Senate districts. And locally, those rules vary, and we see that some legislators have voiced dislike of the ballot initiative. They either because they don't like the inconsistencies they see at the local level, or because they don't like the process and favor the legislative process over it.
Well, and I guess that's where I kind of question this. I mean, the Utah Constitution allows citizens to bring referenda to the ballot, and I guess it feels like some lawmakers feel like no, that's our job. And the problem is that they're not acting on it. I mean, look at, like, forming a nonpartisan redistricting commission, like dealing with the medical cannabis issue, like dealing with Medicaid expansion. I mean, and yet, so they're not dealing with the issues, but yet want to make it more difficult to move for people, citizens, to move the issues along. I don't get that.
Yeah, that is an interesting point. And we heard that refrain that these ballot initiatives represent these perennial issues that voters are voicing their frustration that the legislature might have taken some action, but not enough action, or in the case of redistricting, not the type of action they wanted to see. And so a lot of people thought the legislature would take note of that and recognize that these voters are frustrated, and that's why they are going to the ballot initiative. A lot of legislators are very forthright and honest with their dislike of this process. They say that once that language is submitted for the ballot initiative, you can't tinker with it, whereas within the normal legislative process, they can cross out words, they can cross out lines, or add commas, anything they need to do to add the nuance to the law that is necessary.
Well, we've seen of the five ballot initiatives, I mean, two of them basically being totally rewritten this session, yeah? And more on the way?
So we did see major changes with medical marijuana. We'll see what happens with the Medicaid expansion. I think this will be a much bigger fight in the House than it was in the Senate, and its passage is still pretty far from certain. Things have still been pretty quiet on the redistricting nonpartisan committee. And interestingly, that is what was also happening during the election. It sort of flew under the radar and didn't get too much opposition.
There's also been some commentary in the local news about how if Utah keeps up this ballot initiative thing, we'll be just like California. What do you think they mean by that?
I think most people would agree that we are far from California. Our threshold to get on the ballot for initiative is far higher. And within the past half century, only 9 ballot initiatives have passed Utah. And that would be a slow year for California.
Okay. All right. Hey, finally wanted to ask you, what is the Hinckley Institute watching out for this session? I know you do a bunch of polling throughout the year, trying to keep tabs on issues that matter a lot to citizens. What are you hearing?
We are watching these propositions and the bills that might affect them very closely. We also recently published some polling data through the Salt Lake Tribune about sex education, which we saw came up this week at the legislature, and also about count my vote issues, election reform issues, and we're seeing that the legislature is also looking at ways of how to replace a vacancy when we see that occur with our members of Congress.
Tell me about the sex education bill that you're seeing.
So it actually failed in committee. It tied, which is not enough for the bill to move forward. But Utah's current law prohibits teachers from encouraging the use of contraceptives. And many have argued that that actually makes it so teachers are too nervous to talk about contraception at all. There is a bill to try to clarify that language, but with our polling, we saw that there is support for sex education beyond abstinence only, but we're seeing that the legislature is still debating that and still trying to see if they think that's what's right for Utah schools.
So it sounds like it's DOA then, I mean, if it's failed in committee.
It just might be, but that vote was a lot closer than it's been in the past, and that's always a sign that that slow movement is happening and we might see change in the near future.
Okay, so but could it come back again this year, or is it done for this session?
It always could. We're hearing more and more about these zombie bills that somehow come back to life throughout the session, so nothing's dead until that, you know, midnight strikes on that last day of the session.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to mention, Morgan?
I think this has been a great conversation. If anybody's interested in the Hinckley Institute, our website is hinckley.utah.edu. We have a number of opportunities for students and public events that are free and open to all.
Okay. I appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you so much.
Morgan Lyon-Cotty is the assistant director there at the Hinckley Institute of Politics on the campus of the University of Utah. It's 8:42 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, construction of the new Peace House campus is ongoing. In the studio with an update, I have Sally Tauber, the marketing and development director for Peace House, along with Sharon Mardula. She's the project engineer. Good morning, ladies.
Good morning, Leslie.
Hi, Leslie.
So start with you, Sharon. How far along are we? I mean, are we closing in on the end is in sight here?
Oh, yeah. We hope to be completed by late spring, early summer.
Okay. Well, tell us a little bit about the project. I mean, what have we got out there?
Well, it's a 43,000-square-foot building, two stories. It's going to be a wonderful facility. We are almost, we're all enclosed. We're doing painting right now and getting ready to lay the flooring. Cabinets are in. It's very exciting to see what we've worked on for so many years come to fruition. And I'll let Sally tell you a little bit more about what we're going to have out there.
Okay. Well, so has weather set you back at all?
Oh, yeah. It's been hard. We had hoped to have the asphalt in place, and typically there's a January thaw that would have allowed us to pour, and we didn't get that this year. It's great for the skiers, but not so great for our construction people.
Yeah. Talk to me a little bit about... because the current Peace House has often been kind of hidden and it's kind of a secret location. This is, we've told everybody from day one that this is Peace House and, you know, it's some very vulnerable women. So talk to me a little bit about the security that needs to be part of this.
Well, one of our mission statements has been out of the shadows and into the light. And so we've integrated security into the entire facility. So the residences are all on the second floor. And that when you approach the building, there will be a lockout vestibule that will be open during normal business hours. And then you will have to be buzzed in to enter the clinical area and the administrative offices. And those two will be separated so that when you come into the lobby, you won't be able to get into the clinical area unless you're escorted in or, you know, you have a reason to be there. And then the upstairs area is divided into two sections. There's one for the emergency shelter and one for transitional housing. This is a new endeavor for Peace House. The idea that a victim can rebuild their life in 60 days, which is our maximum stay right now, is kind of optimistic. So we have built in transitional housing, which is for up to 2 years, to allow a family to establish a new life and move on. And so that's further security. And that's going to also incorporate sheltered, closed-in parking. And then that will allow a resident to be able to get a job in the community and then transition out into independence.
Yeah, because what you don't want to see happen, again, is just that whole cycle going back, not being able to do it on their own and then going back to the abuse.
Correct.
Yeah. So the administrative area, I mean, are we talking about metal detectors and bulletproof glass and things like that?
We can't tell you that. It's a secret. No. I don't think we're going to have metal detectors in the building, but and no bulletproof glass at this time.
We have just, that's one of the things we've just added in, is that our front area will have bulletproof glass to protect the volunteer coordinators and the receptionist.
Oh my gosh.
Okay. In terms of fundraising, Sally, are we done? I mean, have we raised the money to complete the building?
Our initial campaign has been met, and we have needs that continue, so we will continue to raise money for different parts of the project. We do have a board-directed building project fund that we're raising money for currently, and we also are raising money for our different needs within the building. Each area of the building is going to grow, the different services. Our emergency shelter will be larger than it currently is. Our transitional housing is new. Our clinical therapy will be larger. We are adding childcare, which we've never had before. Each of these areas has so many needs, and we are reaching out to the community to help us fulfill those needs. I know that you can go on our website right now and go to an Amazon registry and purchase items for the different transitional units to help outfit them, and also for some of the office needs. But you'll hear more about that as we move on.
So that link is on your website at
it
this point?
It is on our website. You can go there and to the donate page, and okay. It will tell you about that.
So given the construction costs that we've seen raise, 20-30% in the last couple of years, how did that impact the project?
we're assessing that because as things move ahead, we have changes occurring, right, Sharon?
Right. Like, for example, we just had a huge change order from our flooring manufacturer because of the tariffs with China. And so we've had to deal with that. And so that's over and above what our construction budget anticipated. You know, things like that that we just weren't able to anticipate 2 years ago.
And in the newsletter to supporters, Sally, you announced that you are seeing a dramatic increase in calls to the 24-hour helpline. Those numbers, I mean, 469 in 2017 jumping to 739 in 2018. I mean, what do you attribute that to?
Better awareness, women seeking help. The hashtag MeToo movement definitely has brought this discussion out in the open, and more people less afraid to receive that help, willing to help.
Yeah, so I mean, that's kind of frightening, though. I mean, given all of the education that you have done, I mean, you've been out into the schools and things like that, or is that just now we have kids who are aware of what's going on?
10,000 children were reached last year in Summit and Wasatch County, and we are rapidly approaching that number for this year. So we are doing as much as we can. We know that statistically that this type of outreach and this type of education makes a huge impact. But remember that we're meeting with children that are 5 years old, 6 years old, all the way up to 17 or 18. So that takes a while before it spins into a change in family abuse that we see.
But I mean, do you think you see the children maybe approach, you know, talking to the mom, saying that this isn't how it's supposed to be?
We very much know that the children in the schools have approached their mothers and said, I learned about this and there is help and you can call this number, mom. And we have had someone enter the shelter under that situation.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
Well, we are just so grateful for all of the support that we've received from the community, and we want to say thank you to everyone. And if you have any questions, please call.
Any word on when you guys going to get a bus out there? Because I was just talking to County Council Member Kim Carson. She says, you know, you can call and get the dialer ride, but right now there's no dedicated bus line there.
Yeah, so those meetings are going to be ongoing, and of course, as the need rises, typically we know that our county and our city responds. So,
okay. Hey, Sally and Sharon, thanks for your time. Coming up on Saturday night, the Park City Institute welcomes back the San Francisco Gays Men Chorus, and with a special edition this year in conjunction with the It Gets Better project. In studio, with details, I have the executive director of the chorus, Chris Verdugo, along with one of the cast members of It Gets Better, Amber Hurst-Martin. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, well, glad to see you back again. So maybe we'll start with you, Chris. I mean, tell us a little bit how the evening's going to work, because in prior years, we've had just the men's chorus singing for us, and now you've got It Gets Better joining you?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the It Gets Better tour is the new national outreach project of the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus. And we just walked in, so I'm literally catching my breath. The snow got the better of us this morning, so here we go. It's a week of residency programs that we do, outreach in schools. We have a World Cafe on Friday morning where we bring in community leaders. So it isn't just a show. The show will happen Saturday night at the Eccles Center. And the show itself is a host of different stories, vignettes really, from videos and stories that the cast members people the cast members have met throughout the 7 years that the tour has been in existence. So it's really sort of this, how would you describe it,
well,
Amber?
Well, it's really amazing, the show, because it's, true stories that we've collected from people from all over the country, people who we've met, and also people that just sent their story into us. And it's that combined with some great singing and dancing and, spoiler alert, some roller skating happens.
So. Okay, so tell us what we're going to see, though. I mean, and how you incorporate this story into what's going to be on the stage.
Well, it's, you know, I have the privilege of playing two different characters. One is a girl from Ohio, which I am a girl from Ohio, so that worked out well. And I also play another person from New York. So, you know, we are the actors telling the stories of these people who sent their story in. And then it's, you know, sort of intertwined with
tell us about that Ohio story a little bit, because that one's very touching.
Yeah. I play the role of Marianne, and she is really a person who's overcome a great deal of adversity in her life. And she is, you know, she's a true it gets better story. She came from an abusive family. They became even further abusive when she, you know, came out to them as gay. And then she was, you know, kicked out of the house. She was homeless for many years. And she eventually, you know, met someone and they started building a life together. And it's really just an incredible story.
It's a beautiful story of hope. And
yeah.
it's a journey of being in a very dark place and you know, through a lot of you know, just torturous times, coming to a place of light. And that's sort of, I think, what encompasses the entire show, is that it's all these different stories. The story of a mother whose son comes out to her, who thinks that, you know, his entire family is going to turn on him, and just the opposite happens. They embrace him in a way that he never thought possible. And stories like the one that Amber just shared, and there's this beautiful trans story, you know, that dives deep into, you know, suicide, and it's very powerful, but at the end, it's a story of redemption and hope. And I think, you know, if you had to kind of sum it all up, the show's about hope.
Mm-hmm.
And what is possible when people open their hearts and when they open their minds.
In the future.
Yeah, and that's really, you know, being the executive director of the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus, we were birthed literally the night that Harvey Milk was assassinated on the steps of the San Francisco City Hall. That was our first public performance. And, you know, we were birthed in that space of hope. I mean, there was so much anger and sadness. It was tragedy. But there was hope. That's what Harvey wanted his legacy to be, and we picked up that legacy. And so for us, it was, you know, it's a joy and an honor, and we're grateful to be able to present, you know, this collaboration with Speak Theater Arts and with It Gets Better Project, this fabulous It Gets Better tour, a relaunch in Park City, Utah.
Yeah, so do you, Amber, always present with the Gay Men's Chorus, or you do your own thing?
It Gets Better. I've been with the cast for about 4 or 5 years now, 4 years, I believe. And, you know, we've had the privilege of working with the Gay Men's Chorus, which is just wonderful. And we've had Chris as our fearless leader for many years now. And, yeah.
Okay, so that you guys are kind of like a package.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The whole cast is like a package. And I was with another chorus, which is where we began this. And when the show first started, it was only just representation of the Gay Men's Chorus. Mm-hmm. And as we were on the road for a few years, we really started to hear from the communities, this is awesome. And we really need stories that tell, you know, the L and the B and the T. And so we started to incorporate those stories as well as those actors. So we've, you know, not in in this particular show, we don't have one of our actors that is gender fluid, but in others we have had.
Yeah.
And we have straight representation, a lesbian representation, mm-hmm. gay representation. And the stories, like I said, they span the spectrum of LGBTQA.
Okay, so how many, I know the chorus is much bigger than what you've got here in Park mm-hmm. City, so you've got how many here and out of how many?
We have, this cast here is a cast of 7, and they interchange their roles continually throughout the show, which makes it very interesting. The San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus is 300 singers strong.
Wow, and what are some of the songs that you'll be singing?
Amber, I'll let you have that one.
There's so many great songs on this show. The music is such a wonderful part of it.
Are they original or are they covers?
Well, some of them are. We have a wonderful person who used to be in the cast with us named Morton Keir, and he's done some great arrangements for us and also written some songs for us. But we do Last Dance, which is really fun. There's some Mariah Carey in the show.
There's some Pink.
Yeah, there's a little Katie Lang. There's almost everything you could ever want.
Really awesome. Yeah, and there's also an original song, written by Jeff Marks, who wrote Avenue Q, and Merv Warren from Take Six. And that song is entitled More Friends Than You Know. And that really is the 11th hour song that sort of caps off what the message of the show is, which is, doesn't matter where you are in life, you honestly have more people around you than you know. You have more friends than you could ever imagine. You just need to reach out. And it encapsulates that, you know, that message the show is trying to bring forth of don't hide, be who you are, and rely on the people around you for that strength.
Okay. And that's a really powerful moment in the show, because we actually will have members of a community chorus here from Park City joining us on stage. So it's very exciting.
Okay, again, showtime is 7:30 p.m. All tickets, $29, 655-3114 or parkcityinstitute.org. Hey, thanks for your time this morning.
Hey, thank you so much.
KPCW News Time now, 8:59.